Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And today I'm speaking with Tomas Summers Sandoval about his book, Latinos at the Golden Gate, Creating Community and Identity in San Francisco, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2013. Tomas is an assistant professor of history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. His research and teaching interests include modern U.S. history, Latino history, oral history, and the social movements of the 1960s. His book, Latinos at the Golden Gate, is the first historical monograph devoted to this important community in San Francisco. Hello, Tomas, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. I wonder if you would begin our conversation today by talking a little bit about yourself and your background.
A pleasure, yeah. Well, as you said, I teach at Pomona College. I'm an associate professor there with a joint appointment in history and Chicano Latino studies, and it's sort of a full circle turn for me. I'm a Southern Californian. I was born down here, born in Monterey Park, and was raised in a town called La Puente, which is about 12-14 miles east of East LA.
Right.
And I went to for undergraduate college. I went to Claremont McKenna College, which is one of the Claremont colleges. Cluster of liberal arts colleges, where Pomona is one of them. And then I went on to grad school at UC Berkeley, got my master's and PhD, and my first teaching job was at California State University, Monterey Bay. And then I was there for a few years before coming here to Pomona, so sort of a homecoming to come back to the Claremont colleges. And my folks are also East LA, born and raised, and grandparents are all immigrants from Mexico. So we're a pretty Southern Californian family. I know, a little odd, I know that an LA kid is writing a book on San Francisco. We're very much in many ways rooted here. A lot of our family stories here. A lot of our family story, too, is kind of involved in education. I mean, I have sisters. I have an older sister who is also a professor of Chicano studies.
Wow.
Her name is Isandoval. She teaches at Cal State Northridge. I have a younger sister who works actually at your campus, work at USC in housing, student affairs.
Oh, wow.
And but growing up, my older sister and I grew up with parents in a household where no one had a college degree, and it was in the 80s that we all sort of started getting educated together. You know, my mom started going to community college, my dad started going to college, and by that time, my sister was applying to colleges, and then I shortly after. So in that sort of 20-30 year period now, we all have college degrees.
That's awesome.
My mom even went to get a master's degree. My little sister got a master's. And then, as I mentioned, my older sister is a professor too. So we're a very pro-education family,
That's awesome. You know, you mentioned Cal State Northridge, and my family has quite some strong ties there. My father and my uncle attended, I think before it was Cal State, I think it was called Valley College. And they took early classes with Rudy Acuna and got involved in some of those the early type of development of Chicano studies programs. And both just mentioned how it was became really a jumping off point for their careers. My father eventually became an educator and elementary school administrator, and my uncle became an attorney working on social justice issues, particularly with farm workers in similar communities. So.
Oh, wow.
I love that connection.
Yeah, and right there, right? I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, one of the kind of the ways that Chicano studies has an impact, you know, it's bigger than just training people like you and me to be academics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
It really does make an impact on folks working in a whole host of areas.
No, that's so true, and I love hearing the stories whenever I hear a lot of those, actually, and I'm sure you probably share this when people ask you what you do, what you're interested in. Oh, you're a historian, what do you study? Typically, when I talk to a number of Latinos, a number of them will tell me how much learning about and studying Chicano history or Latino history really inspired them into either some type of public service or education or something, you know, along professions along those lines.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned how it's kind of odd that a SoCal boy or LA boy would end up writing a history of San Francisco. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that, how you came to write Latinos at the Golden Gate?
Yeah, well, you know, the story of the book really begins kind of the summer before I started my grad work at Berkeley. I had to go find a place to live in the Bay Area, right? Mm-hmm. When you go away to grad school, and I really didn't, have any strong connections there, except for some real good friends that I knew from college that had graduated the year before. And one of my good friends lived in the Castro in San Francisco.
Right.
And so I went to go stay with him while I looked for an apartment over in the East Bay. And if you know about San Francisco, where my friend was staying, the way to get to Berkeley in the East Bay across the way and back into San Francisco is through BART, through their mm-hmm. public transportation system.
Right.
And if you're going to go to the Castro that way, you pretty much have to get off in an area called the Mission District, the Mission. Mm-hmm. And you get off on 16th, and then you walk right up 16th. And so going back and forth for that the better part of a week, I guess, I stayed while I was looking for an apartment. That was my first connection, my first real connection as an adult, to the Mission District, which is the Latino barrio of San Francisco.
Right.
And I would, get off on that 16th Street and Mission Station, and I would start walking, and along the way, I'd grab a coffee somewhere, or I'd stop and buy something in a store to eat, and
right.
It was really clear that there was something, very familiar about it. And something also a little different, right? I mean, it was very familiar to what I knew, as a kid in East Los Angeles. It was very familiar to other Southern California barrios that I was familiar with. But there mm-hmm. were lots of things that left a very different cultural imprint there.
Right.
Sometimes you could see it in the food, differences in food, differences in the way people were speaking Spanish, differences in the things being sold in stores.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of, planted maybe in the back of my mind that there was this community here and that it was a very interesting and dynamic one and that it had a story that I was interested in, at least. And a couple months later, when I took my first one of my first graduate classes in my first semester, I took a research seminar with Professor Waldo Martin, who ended up becoming my advisor,
mm-hmm.
my main dissertation advisor as well. And in that research seminar, you just have to write a history research project.
Right.
And,
right.
And I didn't know how to do any of that. I was so new, I didn't even know what they meant by that. And I was all like, I don't know what to do. And he's all like, how about something on Latinos in San Francisco? And I was like, oh yeah. We started talking about the Mission District, and there you go. It led into a first a paper, and then over the next couple years, I had made that decision to use that as my dissertation topic as well. I tell the story in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have I was sort of homesick,
right,
first couple months, and I mean, I don't know if people share my kind of story in that sense. How many Southern Californians go up to San Francisco, or San Franciscan Latinos coming down to Los Angeles? But that familiarity and that difference is kind of a good thing. It's a very rich kind of tension in a way, right? Because that familiarity really eased any kind of homesickness that I had.
Right, right.
The differences were just so challenging sometimes, right? Like down here in Southern California, I mean, even where I grew up, 15, 20 miles away from, Los Angeles, like you don't have to struggle to find Mexican food in supermarkets.
Right, right.
I mean, here in Southern California, we have this area, the San Gabriel Valley. The San Gabriel Valley is, for all practical purposes, a brown suburb, or a collection of brown suburbs, and has been for my entire life. And so, you can find dried chiles in Albertsons or, Vons. But up in the Bay Area, man, I it was very hard to find simple staples like that, So when I was trying to ease the homesickness by making some familiar food, it turned out that in Berkeley, I couldn't find any of the things that I needed to make like enchiladas, right?
Right,
so
right.
I couldn't find the dried chiles. And so I finally just went to the Mission District, And it was standing in line to buy those, that was really getting us. At that same time, I was sort of thinking what I was going to do as a topic for that class. And just sort of the coincidence of everything sort of speaking to me, the streets of San Francisco speaking to me.
Right.
So that's how I first came to the topic. And then it just grew into the dissertation.
Well, and I appreciate you mentioned both the familiarity of the Latino barrio in San Francisco, the Mission District, as well as the differences, because that's a theme that you pull out throughout the book. The similarities and differences between Latino communities in San Francisco as they are opposed to those in Los Angeles or Southern California. And, I've had somewhat similar experiences, even just in my moves from San Diego, where I grew up, up to LA, kind of where my father at least grew up here, in searching for, similar cuisines. You just notice differences. In San Diego, for example, most of the tacos you get are made with yellow corn tortillas. And at least in the part of LA that we live in, most of the tacos we end up buying are made with white corn tortillas. It's a very small difference, but it kind of speaks to, I think, on a tiny bit, that what you point out, that there are similarities and differences amongst Latino communities, even in something, when you look at a state like California, maybe to outsiders, Latinos in California may be a rather homogenous population, or they would assume that Latino cuisine or Mexican American cuisine would be very similar, throughout a region like Southern California. But you find these very interesting differences, particularly as you cover in your book, these through a series of migrations that occur, from the middle of the 19th century throughout the 20th century. You have a much more diversifying Latino population that is, coming to intermix with the old population and making something quite new. And so, again, that's something that I appreciate that you bring out in your book, and something that resonated with me.
Yeah, I mean, that was, as you can tell from the story I just finished, I mean, that's kind of the heart of what's underneath the whole project, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not only just through the dissertation, but also over the many years later, the 10 years later that it took to develop it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
It's really understanding that heterogeneity, but also a really impactful part of that for me was beginning to think about that heterogeneity in specific ways. Really trying to understand what's the material condition, what's the material context that allows that to happen, that sustains that and also shapes that over a long period of time.
Right.
But also looking at how that heterogeneity can exist even inside of as you're mentioning here, inside of one ethnic group, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there can be differences in the way that that an ethnicity plays out spatially and culturally inside of an urban space, just because there are different urban histories, just because there are different contexts to that.
Right.
So what being Mexican American in Los Angeles is different than being Mexican American in San Francisco.
Certainly,
as well as sharing a lot of of commonalities. That trying to get underneath that story was a big part of what I was very much interested in, you know. And in a lot of ways, it sort of shaped the book in ways that I couldn't even understand as a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out, my first inkling is I got involved in this community and I started to connect very easily with a cultural history, an arts history, and a political history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Those things were very much alive. And I'm talking about the 1994 is that first semester when I'm writing a research paper.
All right. Mm-hmm.
But I'm living in the Bay Area in the 90s, before the first dot-com boom.
Right.
Right. And by the time I'm finishing my dissertation and leaving the Bay Area, the primary story in the Mission is gentrification as it is now. The exodus of Latino communities, the influx of other non-Latinos, the escalation in rents, and all these kinds of things. And so very, very easily I connected really right away with a history that was very much alive. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was one that certainly stretched back, to the 70s, to maybe the 60s. San Francisco is a city that's so rich in its history, in ways that are hard for people to understand, I think, if they're not from there. I mean, everyday people are historians of San Francisco.
Right. Right. I agree.
Everyday people have an archive inside of their closet, inside of their home, on their bookshelf, you know,
mm-hmm.
In their photo albums. I mean, it is a city that is just so rich in a collective sense, with a sense of its history. And those initial things that I connected to in the city really, you know, exposed me to this one idea very early on, which is that there were tensions between, historic tensions and even present day tensions sometimes, between Mexican American population and another Latino population.
Right.
That is between, you know, Chicanos and Latinos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of political and cultural tensions of that. And I was very interested in that, and I thought, oh, you know, after a few weeks working on that, I was all like, you know, I think the story here is how Latinos come into the United States, into a place like San Francisco, and come into a place like a barrio of the Mission District,
right.
And because of the numbers and cultural dominance of Mexican Americans, sort of assimilate to being Chicano more than assimilate to being American.
Mm-hmm.
And that question was a very academic one, right?
Yes.
And it was a little bit dependent on the way that people defined themselves, you know, and terminology and all these. And it took me a long time to sort of work beyond that academic stuff. It was really through the oral history process of just talking to people, spending
mm-hmm.
time with people, getting more familiar with the community, that you realize that the story there wasn't any of these things that I was, you know, in a sense being primed to talk about in the city of San Francisco, that the stories were a little bit different, right? And you had to sort of begin those stories in an authentic way by beginning them and exploring them on the terms of the community members themselves. And so as this project took shape, it became much more of a community history in every way, shape, or form. Not just about the fact that I was writing about a community, but also that my thinking, my analysis was very much reciprocal, was a back and forth with members of that community and with constituencies in that community. So, yes.
Right. Well, and getting to those material conditions, right, and the material specificities of the Latino heterogeneity in San Francisco. You start the book and you state in the introduction, you make this connection to this long history of European imperialism on the development and transformation of the city itself, as well as its demographics, its social and racial order, and its ensuing migrations from Latin America that, you know, even predate the gold rush. And how this is a consequence of U.S. hegemony, European hegemony in the region. So I was wondering if we can start by talking about how, the California Gold Rush, it holds this seminal and, you know, dare I say, sacred place, right, in history of not just the city, but the state of California and the American West,
yeah.
Right, in the American West. And so what you start to tell is, you know, a history of Latinos and, you know, Latin American gold seekers or Argonauts, right, within this whole movement in story becomes a kind of the gold rush sparks this global migration, really, which some scholars argue is like this one of the major periods of global migration that ends up in now what we call globalization. But you tell us from the perspective of Latin Americans. So will you talk a bit more about how do the experiences of early Latin American Argonauts or gold seekers challenge the traditional story that we've heard about the gold rush with all of its accompanying imagery and mythology and, you know, importance to both the sense of, you know, California's identity and to the nation's identity?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, I think one of the real sort of rich ways that the scholarship on the gold rush has evolved over the last, you know, 20, 25 years is an understanding that it's a lot of economic networks that facilitate the movements of people, the movement of capital, and the growth of this Western economy, this Pacific metropolis, as Bancroft calls it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was really exploring that allowed me to expose a lot of the Latino connections. I mean, one of the keys of the period to me, but also the late 19th and early 20th century, was that there is a reason why people from certain parts of Latin America are coming to certain parts of the United States, right?
Right.
It's an old sort of adage, right? We are here because you were there, right? Mm-hmm. There are networks, there are political, economic, and social cultural networks that connect specific parts of Latin America to specific parts of the United States. And beginning with that sort of as an understanding, or developing that understanding as a grad student, but beginning with that as I turned it into a book, was understanding what are the particular kinds of ways that the political economy of San Francisco, first the political economy of a bay that is not yet the city of San Francisco, and then the early city of San Francisco, connect itself to Latin America, and to which parts of Latin America. You start to see that there is this interconnectivity between port towns in South America and in Mexico to the Golden Gate, to the Bay of San Francisco, to Yerba Buena. And in a lot of ways, the gold rush, which, you know, in older sort of literature is seen as this, and even in the romantic common understanding of California's history, is seen as this open, free movement of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now the wealth is there for anybody who wants to go get it, right? And as though there's some sort of equal start to that. That the gold rush really isn't founded on any of those kinds of myths. At the very beginning, it is the network advantage of people in the hemisphere already, primarily Latin Americans, who already have this economic contact with the Bay, who are able to get there quicker, who are the first gold rush explorers.
Right.
You know, it's a ship from Chile that goes into the port of Valparaiso.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first one bringing a bag of gold dust and nuggets, you know, proof that there is a gold rush happening. There are Latin Americans from Chile and from Peru and from Mexico who are going in to San Francisco Bay and then out into the gold fields before the U.S. East Coast is even hearing about it, right? So this is the year before the 49ers,
right,
the 40
right.
meters, you know.
Exactly.
And so these networks advantaged people in Latin America. But also there were very specific ways that networks advantaged people from specific ports in the United States as well. I mean, one of the stories I tell is that passage, right? I mean, if you're not coming across what is the present-day continental United States, if you're not coming across the nation east to west, then there are a few ways that you get to San Francisco, and a common one is going around the Cape and up through the Pacific into the Bay. A much safer form of passage sometimes than crossing the country. And another is that you can go down to Central America and cross over in various parts, Panama and Nicaragua. You cross over through the jungle on foot and then come back up. And so people from the East Coast, European Americans from the East Coast, are also coming through Latin America as part of their story of coming to the Golden Gate, of coming to the Gold Rush, and coming through San Francisco. And in a lot of ways, they carry with them their there's all these little sources of diaries and letters where you get to see that they're carrying with them a lot of their preconceived notions of race and social fitness as they come into San Francisco. And this is, in many ways, part of a generation who are the founders of the city of San Francisco, who are going to be the ones who predominate inside of the social order in San Francisco. And so that part of coming into the city and building the city is also in some ways, dependent upon Latin America and involves Latin America in a big way. It's a way that I found in the sources to be able to tell this story that was really, frankly, exciting for me, because most of the time I'm writing a history of Latinos in San Francisco, it is like looking for needles in a haystack.
Right.
And that's the case for a couple reasons. Some of them are just the context of research in San Francisco. There's not just the major fire that we all know about in 1906, the earthquake and fire of 1906, but there are repeated instances of the city burning down throughout the 19th century.
Right.
And with that is a loss of historical records.
There are
challenges to doing the history of San Francisco before the 19 teens, and that is a big one. But the other one is the product of numbers. Latinos were only a prominent population demographically until the gold rush brought in this avalanche of people from everywhere that made this part of California turn more into, became more like, the American ideal of a white population, a European white population, much quicker than other parts of California, right?
Yes.
As we know inside of Chicano history, ethnic Mexicans maintain numeric superiority in Southern California for another generation or two.
Right.
Even in a political power, that's almost wiped out overnight in San Francisco, and that opening that the gold rush provides also allowed for a very diverse population to come into San Francisco, including a lot of Chinese, as we know, who are a huge part of the story of the city. And in many ways, San Francisco is not a homogeneous city in this time period, even when it comes to their ideas of race. But the sort of more familiar white supremacist notions in San Francisco, the target of their venom are not Latinos, they are Chinese. They are Chinese Americans, the ethnic Chinese population that is living inside of the city, who outnumber all Latinos combined, and who have a much more prominent place inside of the life of the city in many ways that opens them up to a lot more of that venom of being targets of sort of the main target of white supremacy in San Francisco in this period. So even in those other ways of finding sources about Latinos, which is through the mainstream, political system and mainstream press, are very hard, because most of the time when non-white populations are popping up, even in negative ways, the population that's popping up are Chinese Americans. So it was really hard to sort of, find all these kinds of ways of talking about Latinos in this time period. But this was one of the ways that I could do it in a way that proved really fruitful to the argument as well.
Right. And one of the way you do this is, to describe and talk about this population, like, as you mentioned, because it was so heterogeneous in the beginning, beginning with whether it be Chileans and Sonorans and Peruvians, right, is the first kind of gold seekers, and then evolving over time through various waves of migration, is through this concept of pan-ethnic identity, or what in Chicano Latino studies we refer to as Latinidad. So can you talk a bit more about how Latino Americanos in San Francisco began to forge a type of pan-ethnic unity and community? Particularly, you mentioned the role of language and religion. And so can you talk about how that developed and how that helped this community, not just to form, but to, assuage the experience of migration and transnational life and local discrimination, as you began to mention?
Yeah, well, the book couldn't have happened. I would have abandoned the topic a long time ago, probably if not before the dissertation phase, then shortly after. The book certainly couldn't have happened if not for the story of a church, called Our Lady of Guadalupe, La Señora de Guadalupe. Guadalupe Church was the first Spanish language national parish inside of the West. And what that is if your listeners know about Catholic parishes, most Catholic parishes are geographic. And that is they're responsible for a certain neighborhood, right? A national parish is one that is meant to establish and meet the cultural linguistic needs of an entire population. So they cross over geographic boundaries. Our Lady of Guadalupe is a Catholic parish, a Spanish language Catholic parish that was meant to serve the Spanish language population of the city of San Francisco. And it's founded in the 1870s. It's the product of an effort by local elites, primarily political elites, people in consulate offices and people in the business community, to raise money and to get this church built in cooperation with the Catholic Church. And there's a whole story of sort of the context of that and the background of that, that I tell in the book. But I think one of the wonderful things is it's one of these early instances of what we would call in our academic language, Latinidad, of this pan-Latin American descent identity, and taking root inside of their institution building, right? Again, I've always been more interested in sort of the material context of these things than anything else. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly one of those things. As they built this church and as they created a space that on a weekly basis people came as Spanish-speaking Catholics in the city of San Francisco, they naturally formulated an identity of themselves bound to that church, right, in a reciprocal way and in a reciprocal way to each other as well.
Right.
So the story of Guadalupe Church is a story of one of those places. And this is sort of the way that I approach the book, right, is that it's hard to, well, impossible just with a historical record to tell a simple, chronological, sweeping history of Latinos in the city, right, in all of its diversity.
Right.
And instead, what I really tried to focus in on were these moments, where these contexts and these moments where a pan-Latin American, a pan-ethnic identity and context could take shape inside of San Francisco, looking at these institutions and looking at these movements and moments where this happened. And the church was certainly the first one in the city in a clear dynamic way, if not, perhaps the first one in the West or even in the United States as a whole, right?
Right.
I mean, I think one of the fundamental contexts of having this story, one of the beginning things that has to be, if you're telling a story of a diverse, heterogeneous Latin American descent population coming together and developing some kind of cohesive community with one another, one of the beginning points has to be the existence of that diverse, heterogeneous population. And San Francisco has that because of the gold rush, because of its prolonged 19th century financial and commercial position inside of the Pacific. It has that continual flow that I write about in the book, where they have that population. So no other place in the United States has that kind of diasporic representation of Latin America.
Right.
Within its boundaries at that time. And I think it's important, too, that this is a diverse population in terms of class, of economic standards, access to capital and political influence. I mean, this couldn't have happened if everybody who was coming were just farm workers.
Right.
If everybody who were coming were just manual laborers, right, railroad workers. Part of this story taking place, part of the story playing out, is really reliant upon an elite class, an emergent bourgeoisie class, who can all not only bring funds together but also have the political clout to get something done.
Right.
And that says a lot about that commercial linkage story again too, right? With San Francisco and parts of Latin America. So the church becomes this center part of the story. How that church took shape and the kinds of both struggles that existed in them. I mean, the documents that are in the archives about that church, the newspapers that detail the social life and cultural life and religious life of that church. They all detail both the successes of cohesive community formation,
mm-hmm.
Where people are coming together for what they called, for example, unified Spanish masses,
right.
A unity mass or a unified mass, where the different contingents, the ethnic Mexican population, and when I say ethnic Mexican, I mean like Mexican Americans as well as
right.
Mexicanos born in Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of where they're born, or regardless of where they're born. The ethnic Mexican population and Chilean population came together for an annual mass to celebrate the independences of both countries, right?
Right.
So we get instances like that where there's evidence of that cohesion, of that new cultural formation. And all those records also tell, you know, persistent stories of rivalries. Of fights and struggles between these distinct ethnic constituencies of the church too, where there are very strong, in particular through the early 20th century, really strong rivalries between an ethnic Mexican contingent and a Salvadoran and Nicaraguan one,
mm-hmm.
who have battles over the space, so battles over the identity of the church played out, battles over, you know, priests. And who they think priests are showing favoritism to,
right?
You know, all these stories exist too at the same time. So it becomes this wonderful microcosm in many ways of the Latino San Francisco as a whole. You know, sort of playing out inside this church. And then as I read about in that chapter and in the chapter after, Guadalupe Church, which is. It's today, the building is still there. It's no longer a church, but it closed. It ceased being a Catholic church in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that right there is a great indicator of its success over
right.
the long period of time. Right, that for over a century, over a century, it existed as the Latino church inside of San Francisco, or at least a functional Latino church in San Francisco. But it's the building is located. On Broadway, in what is present day, Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
Near where Chinatown butts up against North Beach. And, that church, closes, essentially because most of the population who lives anywhere near it, are not Latino anymore.
Right.
And that's exceedingly the case by the 1940s and 1950s as Chinatown sort of expands out. But also, by the mid 20th century, there are, clusters of Latinos living inside of the Mission District and clusters of Latinos living in other parts of the cities, and also Spanish-speaking priests serving parishes all over the Bay Area, not just in the East Bay either, but also multiple parishes in San Francisco. And all that makes the need of the church sort of dissipate over time. So that's why it finally closes in 92. But up into that, in the high point of its period, in the late 19th and early 20th century, until that ethnic transformation happens in the immediate community surrounding it. Guadalupe also becomes the hub of one of the first Latino barrios in the city.
Right.
A good measure, probably a majority of its constituency, of its parishioners were living within the immediate geography of the church. And, you also see the birth of a bunch of businesses, that start to take place there. Businesses that are, you know, ones we'd expect, supermarkets, restaurants,
mm-hmm.
But also dance halls, you know, lawyers, doctors, printers that are all publishing in Spanish. It becomes the Latino, barrio of the Mexican colony, as they call it, or the Spanish colony, as the press sometimes calls it, in San Francisco. So that church, actually, another, you know, vibrant demonstration of its success is the fact that it creates what anybody would call Latino community, right?
Mm-hmm.
A diverse, heterogeneous group of people living together in the same spaces, you know, patronizing many of the same businesses.
Yeah, and that story I found really interesting because, you know, it is quite unique in the telling of or other narratives of Chicano or Latino history, particularly as we compare it to Southern California, which, as you mentioned, already had a pretty large Mexicano or what were then called, you know, kind of their elite were the Californios, but had a strong Mexicano population as well as a Catholic tradition. You know, you have, you know, the visible edifices of all the missions that ran up and down, you know, the coast of California primarily, but really predominate a lot of the Southern California landscape. But in San Francisco, although you know there was a mission, but you know you didn't have that much of a sense of a strong Latino presence. So I really did enjoy your focus on how this effort to build the Guadalupe Church and that becoming the center, the focal point, and at the same time as a manifestation of a growing Latino community and the relationship the two had in both reflecting the emerging Latino culture and also creating it, you know, and that's what I thought was really, really interesting about this part of the story, that the building, it comes to kind of predate, you know, both kind of like serve as a prologue to what's coming, you know, as far as the church itself, right, as a manifestation in the physical space of the city, but then it continues to evolve. And as far as, I mean, the Latino culture, you know, of the city, as you mentioned, with the demographics that continue to change, other waves of Latin American migrants come, and other Latino populations grow and develop throughout the city, right? And so one of the primary themes of your book, you know, addresses, and we've mentioned this earlier, addresses the role of European imperialism in the formation of, you know, commercial communication and kinship networks that worked in tandem with migration to establish this diverse Latino community in San Francisco. And this was particularly true in the early to mid 20th century, right? As the U.S. solidified its reach and control in many ways of the economic and political conditions in Latin America, which prompted these successive migrations, particularly from Central and South America, which further diversified the Latino population. So I was wondering if you will discuss a bit more, this is going along what we were just talking about, the ways in which Latino migrants remade home in San Francisco. You mentioned that particular phrase, that they remade home, and in many ways it was because these economic and material conditions that had brought them there, it kind of prevented them from returning home. So can you talk a little bit more? You talked about the church and some of the institutions and businesses they built. What else did the community do?
Well, you know, that's where... That's where the foundation of the story for me always was, which is to say that most of the book that's different than the dissertation is what we just talked about, my ability to go back into the 19th and early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my dissertation had focused on sort of the post-World War II period up until probably the 1970s. And most of that was dependent upon a lot of oral histories. And one of the things that really came out of those oral histories were those sorts of very interesting and sort of diverse stories of Latinos who grew up in San Francisco at the time, who migrated to San Francisco at the time. And I can give you an example of sort of the sort of unique differences, I think, is there was a woman I interviewed who actually makes it into the book. because there's like 17, 18 people I interviewed that eventually get cut from this.
Uh-huh.
But Alba Sanchez, who has a super interesting story. She's Mexicana, born in Mexico, and they moved to San Francisco in the post-war period. And they live in a part of San Francisco that does have a lot of Latinos in it.
Mm-hmm.
And her story there is very common. In that post-war migration movement, there is a growing number of Latinos who are moving into this one neighborhood, the Mission. Right, the Mission District. But there are also Latinos scattered still in other parts of the city. And unlike a place like Los Angeles, where it would be probably rare to see Latinos living in places where there aren't other Latinos, there are just the scores of stories that you hear of people who grew up and they were the only one in their school or one of two in their school.
Right.
And in many ways, her acculturation into being an American, her familiarity with becoming a San Franciscan as she was a kid, was dependent upon a different sort of racial context than other Latinos would have in other places. And that was really just a function of those numbers and also the unique diversity of the city. Right? So a lot of her becoming aware of her own Latino-ness, of her own Latinidad, in a sense, of her own history, is really through the prism of the African Americans who she grows up with,
mm-hmm.
and the political and social lives that they're leading, and she's in a kind of, you know, racial dynamic, and the beginning of the civil rights movement becomes very important to her and her community, and eventually sort of she starts to make those connections about her own her own family, her own community history, and her own understanding of rights that are both denied and owed. Those kinds of interesting ways as people begin the daily life of making home, of having children, of having those children be educated inside of these institutions like the schools. That was a part that really just was always alive inside of all these oral histories. And as I said, this was the rich part of San Francisco. Actually, when I began oral histories for this book, this was the second oral history project that I had done in the city. I had done this major oral history project for the city and all these other groups who were farmed out to do the work, mm-hmm. For the demilitarization of the Hunters Point community, the Bayview Hunters Point community, when right. they turned the military base into local usage, and they needed a community history, and I was hired on to interview a bunch of local residents in the Bayside Hunters Point community, Bayview Hunters Point rather, and this was like in the first 2 years of my grad work, and that was my first introduction to sort of the two things. The first, which I mentioned already, that people have such a healthy sense of the city of San Francisco, of their own history, and of the history of the city at large. But also that those stories are so interconnected mm-hmm. with one another. The stories that come through people's memories and the oral histories are really an important story inside of Latino San Francisco and everyone else's San Francisco. And it's this post-war transformation that's happening in the city. There is a realignment of where racial populations are living. And a lot of that is coming from the kinds of economic transformations that are happening inside of the city, right? I mean, as I mentioned in the book, there are still connections, important connections. You know, coffee and fruit are right. coming into the port of San Francisco every day. Mm-hmm. You know, as these commodities come, as these connections develop of the United States and parts of Latin America, so too will those people from those countries come and travel into the city and come looking for work, come as part of those companies engaged in work. But there's also this other transformation that's happening in San Francisco that is one that we focus on a lot in U.S. history in the 70s and 80s, which is the loss of a manufacturing base.
Right.
The deindustrialization of the American economy, mm-hmm. where we move from the old bellwethers of a healthy economy into this new one that we're familiar with in the early 21st century of a intellectual economy, a technology economy. These things are happening, much more vibrantly in San Francisco earlier, but also they're happening everywhere before the 1970s. We just don't focus on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we know from other literature, the end of World War II is really the beginning of this slow de-escalation of the manufacturing base
right.
in the city. In cities all over the United States and in industrial places all over the United States. And certainly it's happening in San Francisco. There's just a steady decline from the 50s to the 60s and 70s and 80s. And with that changes what people are working in, how they're working, and where they're living as a result of work. You know, the Mission District ends up becoming one of these last places that has a good number of factories employing people inside of the city of San Francisco. And Latinos are heavy in employees inside of those factories. The Levi's factory, for example, with it that is now no longer there. But Levi is a company that was founded in San Francisco, founded right. as a result of the gold rush, even. Mm-hmm. And one mm-hmm. of their last factories inside of the city is right there in the Latino barrio. You know, so you know, that change and that tightening up of the labor economy in San Francisco is also bringing in people and bringing them into specific places where they create, you know, community. And I frame that process of creating community as homemaking, you know, Bienle Espiritu's concept of homemaking, you know, this recreation of home. You know, and that builds off of a whole bunch of other, you know, literature inside of Chicano Latino studies as well,
right.
you know, México de Afuera and other concepts. But the interesting ways that they recreated that sense of being, that sense of place, that sense of community, that sense of family. And also in a certain period of time later in the book, also confronting through political and social movements eventually,
right,
to fill the gaps, right, in the things that a community needed and the needs of their community that were going unaddressed, that were going ignored. And then the ways that movements also become another kind of geography. That movements become a geography of where pan-Latino community is also formed.
Right, and can you? I'm glad you mentioned that, because that segued right into one of the last questions I wanted to bring up was the first few chapters of the book focus more on the building of the sense of Latinidad through, you know, processes of first, you know, migration, community formation, and cultural ingenuity and coalescence amidst a diverse Latino population. And while that continues, through the post-war era, your narrative at least shifts to focusing more on social and political movements in the 60s and 70s in particular. And so can you talk about that? Because this is what I thought was really interesting about that part of the book, is that you use Latinidad in kind of a different way. It's certainly place-based, and that's what I appreciate. That you discuss Latinidad as a type of political identity and activity that was specific to San Francisco, at least in the way that that this sense of Latinidad emerged. So can you talk about that a little bit more in regards to the politics and the activism of the generations of Latinos in the 60s and 70s? Can you talk about how their politics and how you can talk about that and how you define it as a form of Latinidad and what that meant, like how it looked like?
I think a key to that was approaching this in ways that I felt were a little bit different than in the ways that I think the scholarly literature would have pushed me to,
mm-hmm,
which is first to think about these things that are in legitimate ways thought of as identity movements,
mm-hmm,
are movements that are very much involving identity and both create new identities, also rely upon identity in order for their formulation, for their constitution. But to think about identity movements differently, to not think about them solely as movements about identity,
mm-hmm, right,
but to look at what the material sort of space is again of these movements taking place. And that really helped me decide which ones to talk about and which ones not to talk about,
mm-hmm,
or which ones to focus more of my energy and time on rather than others. And I think where the kinds of movements that were really about people coming together to address certain kinds of spatial and context power relations that were the most vibrant for me. And in this way, Latinidad again becomes a function of a very specific kind of social, political, economic geography.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And the same is sort of true, I think, for the last chapter of the book, which focuses on sort of movements for a younger generation, sort of what we might think of as the Latino baby boomers,
mm-hmm,
of San Francisco, you know, give or take, depending on when you define the generation.
Right, yes. Uh-huh.
And thinking about those more youth-based movements, which are very much more identity-centered, or at least an identity, a political identity that's reliant and reflective of a very specific kind of analysis of power and self and community. But that even those were rooted to very specific kinds of, or the ones I focused on were rooted to very specific kinds of economic and demographic context.
Mm-hmm.
And so in doing that, that's how they sort of connect up to this longer story of how Latinos are coming together and developing these institutions, these spaces where a pan-Latino identity can be formulated and expressed. And,
right,
and, that also sort of reflects how it's not just about, or even much about language at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are they calling themselves Latino here? Or
right,
are they calling themselves Latino there? Cause it's a whole host of different terms that reflect that pan-ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And also that pan-ethnicity doesn't necessarily shove away your own particular ethnic identity,
right,
at the same time, right? They're the coalescence of multiple kinds of identities coming together in political formation.
Nor did it, as you mentioned, nor did it exclude non-Latinos, right? I mean, you mentioned this Latinidad was very inclusive.
There right there is a perfect window into that unique demographic reality of San Francisco, right? That even the Mission District, which is becoming increasingly Latino in the post-war period, up to the point later on where it would be probably a Latino majority, in the period after the book is written, but it's almost half in the period where the book stops. That means that half of the community is not Latino.
Right, right.
That the Mission District is primarily the thing that ties it together, and you can see that now in its continual battle against gentrification.
Right.
What really ties it together is a cohesive class reality and
yes,
identity,
yes. Uh-huh.
Class experience. It is a working class community,
mm-hmm.
and it was a multiracial working class community at that time. A working class, multiracial, multi-ethnic community, multi-generational community that had a Latino plurality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was also whose cultural changes and whose immediate present was being determined by the Latino population, right? They were the fastest growing, and they were the ones who were clearly emerging as the largest, had already emerged as the largest. So that presents certain kinds of challenges, right? That if there's going to be a legitimate community organization that really does manifest itself into real community power, where this population can have some control over the space, some autonomy over the geographic space in which they're living, the neighborhood in which they're living, that it had to do more than just bring Latinos together, bring that Latino diversity together. It had to also bring together that multiracial, multi-ethnic population together, too. That's the only way it could have a legitimate presence, an authentic presence, an authentic democratic kind of presence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story that I tell in a group called the Mission Coalition Organization,
right.
Which is
mm-hmm.
in many ways just like a wonderful like snapshot of the beauty of the politics of San Francisco in the post-war period,
right.
post-World War II period. The MCO is dependent upon primarily two groups of people early on. One are the aging homeowning population of the Mission District, who are white European American. Many are immigrants, but from European countries. Many are U.S. born Americans, and they're the property owners. And then the largest property renter class of Latinos. And that Latino group at that time was being represented by enough of a collection. There was enough of a healthy political establishment inside of the Mission and the city as a whole that become the initial sort of foundation of the Latino constituency inside of the MCO. And that's groups that are still pretty diverse. There's political groups. There's groups who are working through things like war on poverty.
Mm-hmm.
There's labor organizations, right? There's things like MAPA and other political organizations that were part of the city. There's some Spanish-speaking religious base there as well. But they're able to sort of come together too. And the first fight is really just opposing redevelopment.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it starts. The Mission District was next in line to be gutted and turned into the city of the future that San
right.
Francisco was becoming. And the people, both the property owners and the Latinos and others inside of the Mission District, had seen what had happened to the redevelopment story of the Western Addition Fillmore District, of an African American community that was essentially gutted and displaced, where urban renewal becomes urban removal, as,
right.
as the language goes. And so they just wanted to stop it. And they did. They came together effectively, and they stopped it in that sort of diverse group. And then later what happens is the opportunity of a war on poverty, essentially a war on poverty program called the Model Cities Program, a federal funded way that is a little bit bigger than just redevelopment. That it's really more sort of a holistic renewal inside of a community. It could be about jobs, it could be about health, it could be about buildings, it can be about a whole bunch of things. But it was about funding community improvements through the community itself in a typical war on poverty fashion, right? That you have to have in a large, authentic constituency representing the community to get that funding. And so when the model cities possibility started getting talked about in the board of supervisors and city hall, they come together in the Mission District again to not only this time just oppose outright redevelopment, but to control model cities.
Right.
And model cities will give them control over a lot of funds, and it's creating this this multi-issued organization that they call eventually becomes called the Mission Coalition Organization, where they're doing the work on the issues that they want funded through model cities, while they're also fighting for control of that model cities program that represents clearly one of like the high points of the Mission District story of the last century. I mean, it involves a critical mass of that community. It involves a super majority of the community organizations of that neighborhood. It's a multi-issued organization. It works on coalition. It has this representative structure, where in the case of Latinos, you see a lot of the diversity being represented. They create a vice president position for all these different kinds of groupings, like elderly and youth. There's a Mexican American, there's a Central American, there's a Salvadoran, Nicaraguan, vice president, and everybody knew what those terms would mean, right? Like the Central American wouldn't be, filled by a Salvadoran, right? That the Latin American wouldn't be filled by a Mexican, right? But they create this organizational structure that literally gives every identified constituency space at the leadership table. And they create campaigns around the issues that they were most concerned about. I mean, I think they do it in a creative and in a really effective way as well. To give you an example of those, I mean, I think two really great stories of them. The first is there was an adult theater right there in the heart of the Mission District, in the heart of the commercial area of the Mission District. In this time period, and more, of course, the mission at this time are families. They don't want that theater there, but you know, this is the sort of slummy part of town to the city of San Francisco. And they want to get that adult theater, pushed out of town. And, the way that they do it is they dress people up as nuns and they give them cameras. And as people walk into the theater, they take pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And as
mm-hmm.
people are parked in the theater, they pitch into the car and they hand out flyers saying that we're gonna, you know, tell your families that you come here, or tell your local priest or minister that you come here.
Right.
The people who were dressed as nuns were not nuns.
Right.
Were not nuns. The cameras didn't even have film in them. Right. But this is a way of them finding these kinds of creative forms of theater almost to express their agency over that space. This is
right.
our community, right? This should be something that meets the entertainment needs even of our community.
Mm-hmm.
And another is their jobs effort. Their jobs committee, their employment committee was really their largest success. They would have the largest grouping of people involved in it on a weekly basis. The reason was is that it developed this really interesting point system, and that point system only came after their success in negotiating with local employers for jobs for youth, jobs for adults. One of the first campaigns, I had the really just great fortune of interviewing very early on. Like the very first interview I did in the late 90s was with a man named Mike Miller. Mike Miller is a wonderful San Franciscan.
mm-hmm.
He was the organizer of the organizer behind for the Mission Coalition Organization. He was mm-hmm. their hired organizer. I would just say he's not the head of it, right?
But right.
he's the person who comes in to do the actual grassroots organizing work for it as an employee of them. Mike has a long history in the city. He was part of the Berkeley movement known as Slate that takes over student government and that leads into the free speech movement.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head of the SNCC office, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee office in the city of San Francisco, so a participant in that kind of avenue of it. He worked for Saul Alinsky and was a really close associate. He was very young compared to Saul towards the end of his life.
Right.
He had a very personal relationship with Saul Alinsky, as well as a professional one where he learned a lot from him. And Mike also, at that time in the basement of his house, had just a line of I don't even know how many file cabinets it was, 15, 20, that were just filled with all the records of his professional life. And so his archive and his oral histories became the foundation of this chapter. Wow. So Mike helped start to organize this employment committee that negotiated with the local employers for jobs. And the first one was one of the first ones was Wonder Bread. It had a factory right there in the Mission, and they thought, well, this is a good opportunity for them to hire a couple of high schoolers. Let's mm-hmm. just get them to agree to hire some high schoolers. And that turned into some summer jobs, and that turned into some jobs after they went back to school for adults, and other employers were following suit. And they were thinking, well, how are we going to get these jobs to people? Like, how are we going to choose who gets these jobs? Because a part of the agreement was, we would provide the person to you. You hire the person we provide. And what they do is they created the point system, and the point system was, you got points by attending meetings of the MCO, by doing work and participating in campaigns of the MCO, by working in the office of the MCO. And the people who were in the employment line that had the most points were the first ones to get the job.
Mm-hmm.
So that just, you know, the employment committee just, you know, balloons overnight once they start getting jobs into one of their largest committees. But it's a wonderful reflection of what's at play. The MCO is not just some sort of movement where people are protesting
right.
for something
right.
in City Hall. What they are doing, what Mike is doing is grassroots, in a grassroots way. He is organizing people together to create their own institutions that
mm-hmm.
they control, their own committees, their own campaigns that they control, in order to create the changes that they want in their community. And people come together in that committee, and in many ways it's like a crucible, right, of where all these various identities, interests, histories get blended into one another, and through the heat of that movement and those times, it gets to produce this very specific kind of Latino Mission identity that is the dominant one inside of that organization. Even though it would be wrong to call that organization just a Latino organization.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's much bigger than that, and has many different diverse constituencies involved in it as well.
Right. You mentioned earlier that the MCO is a great window into the, you know, politics and movements of San Francisco at the time. I also found it very encouraging, and a reminder of what's possible and how to build broad coalitions that address the needs of communities and working people and engage them in the democratic process. So I definitely think it's part of one of those, it's a part of history that we can really, it deserves reading for the contemporary era and thinking about, okay, how can we apply this to the current situation? Because that's the reality in many of, our cities and urban centers, you know, throughout the country. I mean, despite the fact that the Latino population has boomed and, becoming the predominant minority community of most major metropolitan centers, still in their need to address issues that are important to their communities, right? There's the need to build broader based coalitions that allow people to work with you and identify with these issues beyond just the sense of ethnic identity. All right, Tomas. So thanks again for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I appreciate all the discussions that we've had about your book and these really fascinating topics and different ways Latinidad was established in San Francisco. I was wondering if you could wrap up our time together. I'm very interested. I know you have a new project that you're working on, and I was wondering if you could spend a few moments talking about that.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for the chance to do that. It's a little different of a project, but it's one that's still very close to my heart. I'm writing a book on the easy way to talk about it is the impact of the Vietnam War on Latino communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been my work for the last 4 years, really, collecting oral histories with Chicano and Latino Vietnam veterans,
great,
primarily here in California.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm also interviewing their families, family members, as well as children. And the goal here isn't to write a book of war stories, but really to think about the myriad ways that the war impacted Chicano community formation, Latino community formation in the Southwest in the 40 years since the war ended. And also to I mean, really clearly, it's sort of unavoidable. It's so clear it's to be able to use the life experiences of these families as a window into the history of this generation of baby boomers coming of age in the 60s as well. So it's a much bigger thing than I think than just sort of telling, recounting, or even celebrating sort of war stories and war service. It's really looking at how communities' economic and political histories are shaped by family members' participation inside of the military in this time period. And as I said, it's a personal story because it's very much my own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm born in 1972, and my father's a Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
His older brother, my uncle, is also a Vietnam veteran. Probably growing up, every other male I knew, every other adult male I knew was a Vietnam vet. You know, most of the dads in the grade school I went to were Vietnam veterans.
Wow.
It wasn't until a little bit later on, you know, that when you're a kid and you realize, wait a minute, everybody's dad's not a Vietnam veteran. You don't expect 100%, but
right.
it felt way bigger than the. I mean, it's only 10% of that generation.
Right.
Only 10% mm-hmm. of the males of that generation participated in the Vietnam War. Like,
wow.
You know, the specter of Vietnam hung over that generation so
yes.
much.
Yes.
I still find it a little shocking that, considering that's the cultural social history that we talk about, that 90% of them, you know, never got entangled in this business.
Right. That's a striking
statistic. That experience of not just, you know, individually with these many individuals, what looked like, you know, as a small kid, disproportionate, although I wouldn't call it that. I wouldn't have had a sense of that then. But, you know, from my memory of what I thought of as a kid, what I could see is that disproportionate kind of way, that inequitable, unequal way that Chicanos and Latinos were involved in this war. But also, I think that kind of like understanding is kind of part of that larger story I'm talking about. It's not mm-hmm. just about that structure and the way that it impacts individuals, but how it also impacts the larger kind of community where a critical mass, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
inside of the barrios of the Southwest of our communities have this as a common story, as a thread.
Right.
The tie to follow up. And what's the long-term kind of impact of that in all the kinds of ways that we need to think about.
No, that sounds great. And that's definitely another, I know work has been done within, you know, Chicano and Latino studies on Vietnam War, but your approach to it definitely sounds novel and very interesting and much needed work. That statistic you just cited was striking to me, that only 10% of that generation actually served in the war. That's, in my own direct family, neither my father nor his brother served in the war, but they were so much, you know, affected by it, you know, and mobilized, you know, to activism and their eventual professionalization, as we discussed earlier. So definitely look forward to reading that and hopefully having you back on when it's done.
Oh, thank you. I would jump at the chance. I appreciate it.
Great. Hey, Tomasco, again, I appreciate your time, and I encourage our listeners to get a copy of your book, San Francisco Latinos at the Golden Gate, and to read it and discuss it with others. And again, appreciate very much you taking a moment out of your day today.
And my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Thanks again for tuning into New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and you have been listening to my conversation with Tomas Summers Sandoval about his recent book, Latinos at the Golden Gate, Creating Community and Identity in San Francisco, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2013. Again, if you would like to contact us at New Books in Latino Studies, please do. You can reach us either on Facebook or by sending an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com.